A lot has happened since then. Her voice was so slow and certain. Maureen lifted her head. The girl's face was still pale, but it suddenly shone with disarming clarity. Maureen maybe gave a start or even cried out, because the garage girl laughed. "Get yourself to Berwick-upon-Tweed!"
Chapter 29 Harold and Queenie. After writing his letter, Harold had persuaded a young man to buy him an envelope and a first-class stamp. It was too late to visit Queenie, so he spent the night in his sleeping bag on a bench in the municipal park. Come the early morning, he visited the public lavatories, where he washed and combed his hair with his fingers. Someone had left a plastic razor on the sink, and he pulled it through his beard. It didn't give him a proper shave, but the bulk of it was gone, so that it was more like prickles than curls. But the odd tuft remained. The flesh around his mouth looked bleached, and somehow disconnected from the leathery skin that held his nose and eyes. He lifted his rucksack over his shoulder and made his way to the hospice. His body felt hollowed out, and he wondered if he needed food. He had no appetite. If anything, he felt sick. The sky was covered with thick white cloud, although the salt air smelt already warm. Cars of families were arriving with picnics and chairs to set up home on the beach. Far out on the horizon, the metal sea sparkled against the morning light. Harold knew an end was coming, but had no idea how it would be, or what he would do afterwards. He turned into the drive of St. Bernardine's Hospice, and once more walked the length of the tarmac. It had been recently laid. His feet fell softly. He pressed the buzzer without hesitating, and while he waited he closed his eyes and groped for the wall. He wondered if the nurse who would greet him might be the same woman he had spoken with on the telephone. He hoped he wouldn't have too much to explain. He hadn't the energy for words. The door opened. Before him stood a woman whose hair was covered, and who wore a long, cream, high-collared robe, with a belted black overgarment. His skin shivered all over.
"I'm Harold Fry," he said. "I have walked an awfully long way to save Queenie Hennessy." He was suddenly desperate for water. His legs trembled. He needed a chair. The nun smiled. Her skin was soft and smooth. What he could see of her hair was grey at the roots. She reached out her hands and took Harold's between her own. They were warm and rough, strong hands. He was afraid he would cry.
"Welcome, Harold," she said. She introduced herself as Sister Philomena and urged him to enter. He wiped his feet, and then he did it again. "Don't worry," she said. But he couldn't stop. He was pounding his shoes on the threshold. He lifted them to check there was nothing on them, and he was right. But still he kept scraping his soles against the stiff mat, the way he used to have to do for his aunts before they would allow him into the house. He stooped to unpeel the duct tape, but it took a while and kept attaching itself to his fingers. The longer he took, the more he wished he wasn't doing it.
"I think I should leave my yachting shoes at the door."
The air inside was cool and still. There was a smell of disinfectant that reminded him of Maureen, and another that was hot food, possibly potato. He used the toe of one shoe to ram his other foot free, and then he repeated the process. Standing in his socks, he felt both naked and small. The nun smiled.
"I'm sure you're longing to see Queenie." She asked if he was ready to follow, and he nodded.
Their feet marked the passage along the blue carpet in silence. There was no applause.
There were no laughing nurses, no cheering patients. There was simply Harold, following the loose silhouette of a nun down a clean and empty corridor. He wondered if he could hear singing in the air, but listening again, he thought he was probably imagining it. Maybe it was the wind trapped in the Velux's windows ahead, or someone calling. He realized he had forgotten to bring flowers.
"Are you all right?" she said.
Again he nodded. As they reached them, Harold noticed the windows to his left opened out over a garden. He looked with longing at the closely cropped lawn, and imagined his bare feet sinking into its softness. There were benches set out and a sprinkler, whipping the air with bowing curves of water that caught the light from time to time. Ahead there stretched a series of closed doors. He was sure Queenie must be behind one of them. He fixed his gaze towards the garden and felt a powerful surge of dread.
"How long did you say you had been walking?"
"Oh," he said. The significance of his journey was reducing to nothing, even as he followed her. "A long time." She said,
"I'm afraid we didn't invite those other pilgrims inside. We watched them on the television. We found them altogether rather noisy."
She turned, and he thought she gave a wink, though that was surely not possible. They passed a half-open door. He wouldn't look inside.
"Sister Philomena," called a voice, frail as a whisper.
She stopped, looking into another room, her arms stretched out between the doorframe.
"I'll only be a moment,"
she said to whoever was inside. The nun stood, with one foot slightly lifted and pointed behind her, as if she were a dancer, but wearing trainers. Turning back to Harold, she gave a warm smile and said they were nearly there. He was cold or tired, or something that seemed to squeeze the life out of him. The nun walked a few more paces and stopped and knocked gently at a door. She listened a moment, with her knuckles resting on the wood and her ear flat against it. And then she opened the door a crack and peered inside.
"We have a visitor,"
she said to the room he could not yet see. Pushing the door to the wall, she flattened herself against it as he passed.
"How exciting," she said.
He took a deep breath that seemed to come from his feet, and lifted his gaze to the room ahead. There was no more than a window, with thin curtains partially drawn, and beyond that a sky that appeared far away. There was a simple bed set under a wooden cross, with a pan beneath it and an empty chair at its side.
"But she's not here."
He felt a giddying wave of unexpected relief. Sister Philomena laughed.
"Of course she's here."
She nodded in the direction of the bed, and looking at it again he found a slight form beneath the ice-white sheets. Something stretched at its side, like a long white claw. And then as Harold peered again, it occurred to him that this was Queenie's arm. He felt the blood rush to his head.
"Harold?"
came the nun's voice. Her face was close to his, the skin a web of fine wrinkles.
"Queenie is confused and in some pain, but she has waited. As you said she should."
She withdrew to let him pass. He took a few steps closer, and then a few more, with his heart throbbing. And as Harold Fry finally arrived at the side of the woman for whom he had travelled so many miles, his legs almost gave way. She lay, not moving, only a few feet from his touch, her face towards the light at the window. He wondered if she was sleeping, or maybe drugged, or waiting for something that wasn't him. It was intensely private, the way she did not move or notice his arrival. Her body made almost no shape against the sheets.
She had the smallness of a child. Harold pulled the rucksack from his shoulder and held it flat against his stomach, as if to keep the image in front of him at bay. He ventured one step closer. Two. What was left of Queenie's hair was thin and white, like a seed head in a hedgerow. Puffed over her scalp and pulled sideways, as if she had been caught in a violent wind. He could see the papery thin skin of her skull. Her neck was bandaged. Queenie Hennessy looked like someone else, like someone he had never met. A ghost, a shell. He glanced behind him for Sister Philomena, but the doorway was empty. She had gone. He could drop the presents and go, maybe with a card. The idea of writing seemed by far the best idea. He could say something comforting. A burst of energy shot through him. He was about to retreat when Queenie's head began a slow and steady journey from the window, and he was struck, still again, watching. First came the left eye, then the nose, then the right side of her cheek, until she was facing him, and they met for the first time in 20 years. Harold's breath stopped. Her head was all wrong. It was two heads in one. The second growing out of the first. It began somewhere above her cheekbone and protruded over the jaw. It was so big, this growth, this second face without features. It looked as if it would erupt through her skin at any moment. It had forced the right eye to close, and was tugging it towards her ear. The lower half of her mouth was jammed sideways and sliding towards her jaw. It was inhuman. She lifted her claw fingers, as if to hide. But there was no not seeing. Harold groaned. The noise was out of him before he was aware of making it. Her hand groped for something she didn't find. He wished he could pretend it wasn't horrible to look at, but he couldn't. His mouth opened and two words shuffled out. "Hello, Queenie." Over 600 miles, and that was all he could come up with. She said nothing. "It's Harold," he said. "Harold Fry." He was aware he was nodding, and shaping the words with exaggeration, and directing them not at her disfigured face, but at her claw hand. "We worked together a long time ago. Do you remember?" He snatched one more glance at the gargantuan tumor. It was a shining, bulbous mass of thread-like veins and bruising, as if it hurt the skin to contain it. Queenie's one open eye blinked at him. From the other slid a trail of something wet towards her pillow. "Did you get my letter?" The look was naked, like an animal trapped inside a box. "My postcards?" "Am I dying?" said her marble eye. "Will it hurt?" He couldn't look. Pulling open the rucksack, he rooted through its contents. Although it was dark inside the bag and his fingers were trembling, and he was so aware of Queenie watching him, he kept forgetting what he was looking for. "I have some small souvenirs. I picked them up as I walked. There's a hanging quartz that will look nice at your window. I just have to find it. And some honey somewhere." It dawned on him that with a growth that size she probably couldn't eat. "You may not like honey, of course, but the pot is nice for putting pens in, maybe. It's from Buckfast Abbey." He pulled out the paper bag containing the rose pendant and offered it to her. She didn't move. He laid it a little way from her clawed hand. He patted it twice. When he looked up, his skin froze. Queenie Hennessy was slipping down the pillow, as if the weight of her terrible face was dragging her earthwards. He didn't know what to do. He knew he should help, but he didn't know how. He was afraid that underneath her bandaged neck there would be more. More butchery. More brutal evidence of her human frailty. He couldn't bear that. Harold called for help. He tried to do it quietly at first, so as not to alarm her. But then he called again, getting louder and louder.
"Hello, Queenie,"
called the nun, entering the room. Only it seemed this was not the same one as before. Her voice was younger, her body fuller, and her manner more bold.
"Let's get some light. It's like a morgue in here."
She walked to the curtains and tugged them back with a yank, so that the rings screamed on the metal pole.
"How nice to have a visitor."
Everything about her struck Harold as too alive for the room, and for Queenie's fragile condition. It made him angry they had let her look after someone so delicate as Queenie, although he was relieved she was able to take over.
"She's—"
He couldn't finish the sentence. He pointed.
"Not again," said the nun, all bright, as if Queenie was a child and had spilt food down her blouse.
From the other side of the bed, she adjusted Queenie's pillows and pulled her upright, hooking her under the armpits and lifting. Queenie submitted like a rag doll. And that was how Harold thought he would always remember her. Enduring and enduring, while someone hoiked her against a pillow and made funny comments that he hated.
"Apparently Henry has walked all the way from... Where are you from, Henry?"
Harold opened his mouth to explain that he wasn't Henry, and that he lived in Kingsbridge. But the will to say either disappeared. It didn't seem worth the effort of correcting her. At that moment, it didn't even seem worth being himself.
"Dorset, did you say?"
said the sister.
"Yes, that's right," said Harold, adopting the same tone, so that it sounded for a moment as if they were both shouting over the sea wind. "Down south."
"Shall we offer him tea?"
she asked Queenie, without looking at her.
"You sit yourself down, Henry, and catch up while I make us all a cuppa. It's been pretty busy for us, hasn't it? There have been so many letters and cards. Last week a lady even wrote from Perth."
She turned to Harold as she left.
"She can hear you," she said.
He thought that if Queenie could really hear, it wasn't considerate to go talking about it. But he didn't say that. They were down to basics now. Harold took the chair at Queenie's bedside. He scraped it back a few inches so as not to be in the way. He slotted his hands between his knees.
"Hello," he said again, as if they were meeting for the first time. "I must say you're doing very well. My wife, do you remember Maureen? My wife sends her best regards."
It felt safer now that he had conjured Maureen into the conversation. He wished Queenie would say something to break the ice, but she didn't.
"Yes, you're doing well."
And then,
"Really, really well."
He looked behind to see if the nun was on her way with the tea, but they were still alone. He gave a long yawn, although he felt wide awake.
"I walked a long time," he said weakly. "Shall I hang up your cords? In the shop they had it at the window. I think you'll like it. It's supposed to have healing powers."
Her opened eye met his.
"But I don't know about that."
He wondered how much longer he was going to have to go through this. He got up, with the cord swinging on its thread between his fingers, and pretended to look for a suitable place to hang it. The sky beyond the window was so white he couldn't tell if it was cloud or bright sun. Down in the garden, a nun in a straw hat pushed a patient in a wheelchair across the grass. talking gently. He wondered if she was praying. He envied her certainty. Harold felt the stir of old emotions and images from the past, buried for all this time, because living with them every day was more than a human being could bear. He gripped the windowsill, taking deep breaths. But the air was hot, too, and brought no relief. He lived again the afternoon he had driven Maureen to the funeral director's to see David one last time in the coffin. She had packed a few things, a red rose, a teddy bear, and a pillow to go beneath his head. In the car, she had asked Harold what he was going to give, knowing he had nothing. The sun had shone very low, torching his eye as he drove. They both wore sunglasses. Even at home, she didn't take them off. At the funeral director's, she had surprised him by saying she wanted to say goodbye to David alone. He had sat outside with his head in his hands, waiting his turn, until a passerby had stopped to offer a cigarette, and Harold had taken it, although he had not smoked since the days on the buses. He tried to imagine what a father said to his dead son. His fingers shook so hard on the cigarette, the passerby used three matches to light it. The thick nicotine caught in his throat and wound through his insides, causing them to tip upwards. As he stood and bent over a rubbish bin, he was met with the bitter stench of decay. Then, from behind him, the air was pierced with a harsh, deep, sobbing cry. So animal in its intensity, he was struck still, braced over the contents of the bin.
"No!"
Maureen screamed from inside the funeral parlour.
"No, no, no!"
The words seemed to reverberate through him and beat against the metal sky. Harold had heaved a white spume of foam into the bin. When she came out, she caught his eye once, and then her hand shot to her sunshades. She had been crying so hard her whole being seemed liquid. He realized with shock how thin she had grown. Her shoulders were like a hanger inside her black dress. He wanted to walk to her, to hold her, and be held. But he smelt of the cigarette and his vomit. He hovered beside the bin, pretending he had not seen her, and she walked straight past him to the car. The space that set them apart shone against the sun like glass. He wiped his face and his hands, and eventually he went after her. As they drove home in silence, Harold knew that something had passed between them which could never be undone. He had not said goodbye to his son. Maureen had, but Harold had not. There would always be this difference. There followed a small cremation, but she wanted no mourners. She hung up net curtains to stop people prying, although sometimes he felt it was more to stop herself from seeing out. For a while she railed and blamed Harold. And then even that stopped. They passed one another on the stairs and were no more than strangers. Harold thought of the day when she came out of the funeral director's and looked at him before snapping down her sunglasses. And he felt that in that one glance, they had made a pact that would oblige them for the rest of their lives to say only what they did not mean, and to wrench apart what they most loved. Remembering all this in the hospice where Queenie lay dying, Harold trembled with pain. He had believed that when he saw her, he could say thank you and even goodbye. That there would be a meeting of a kind, and that somehow it would absolve the terrible mistakes of the past. But there could not be a meeting, or even a goodbye, because the woman he had once known had already left. Harold thought he should stay, leaning on the windowsill, until he could accept this. He wondered if he should sit again, if being in the chair would make a difference. But even before he sat, he knew it wouldn't. Sitting or standing, he knew that it would take a long while before he could sew into the fabric of his life the knowledge that Queenie was reduced to this. David was dead, too. There was no bringing him back. Harold tied the cords to a curtain ring with a quick knot. It hung against the light and twisted, so slight it was barely noticeable. He remembered fiddling with his laces the day David almost drowned. He remembered driving from the funeral parlour with Maureen, knowing everything was over. There was more. He saw himself as a boy, after his mother had left, prostrate on his bed, and wondering if the stiller you kept, the greater the chances might be of dying. And yet here, years later, was a woman he had known briefly but tenderly, fighting to keep the small amount of life that was left. It was not enough. It was not enough to stay on the sidelines. In silence, he walked to Queenie's bedside, and as her head turned and her eye found his, he sat in the space beside her. He reached for her hand. Her fingers were fragile, barely flesh at all. They curled imperceptibly and touched his. He smiled.
"It seems a long time since I found you in the stationery cupboard," he said.
At least he wanted to say that, but maybe it was only a thought. The air remained still and empty for a long time, until her hand slipped out of his, and her breathing grew slow. A rattle of china caused him to start.
"Are you all right, Henry?"
asked the young sister, jollying into the room with a tray. Harold looked again at Queenie. She was dozing.
"Do you mind if I leave the tea?" he said. "I have to go now."
And Harold did. Chapter 30. Maureen and Harold. Alone, a broken figure sat on a bench, hunched against the wind, and looking out towards the water's edge, as if he had been there all his life. The sky was so grey and heavy, and the sea so grey and heavy, that it was impossible to tell where one began and the other ended. Maureen paused. Her heart hammered inside her ribs. She walked towards Harold, and then she stopped again, standing right beside him, although he didn't look up or speak. His hair touched the collar of his waterproof jacket in soft curls that she ached to reach out and stroke.
"Hello, stranger," she said. "Do you mind if I sit with you?"
He didn't answer, but he tucked his jacket close to his hips and shunted along the bench to make space. Waves came at the beach and broke in white fringes of foam, flinging forward small stones and broken pieces of shell, and then leaving them behind. The tide was coming in. She took her place beside him, but a little way apart.
"How far do you think those waves have travelled?" she said.
He shrugged and shook his head, as if to say, "That is a very good question, and I really don't know." His profile was so hollow it looked eaten away, and shadows hung beneath his eyes, dark as bruises. He was a different man yet again. He seemed to have aged years. What was left of his beard was pitiful.
"How was it?" she said. "Did you visit Queenie?"
Harold kept his hands slotted between his knees. He nodded. He didn't speak. She said,
"Did she have any idea you were arriving today? Was she pleased?"
He gave a sigh like something cracking.
"You did see her?"
He nodded, but the nod kept moving up and down, as if he had omitted to send his brain the message to stop.
So did you talk? What did you say? Did Queenie laugh?
Laugh? He repeated.
Yes, was she pleased?
No. His voice was weak. She didn't say anything.
Nothing? Are you sure?
Another series of nods. His reticence was like a disease. It seemed to creep over Maureen, too.
She tugged her collar closer to her chin. She had expected him to be sad and exhausted, but that, she had assumed, would come from finishing his journey. This was a sort of apathy that sucked the life out of you.
She said, "What about her presents? Did she like them?"
I left the rucksack with the nuns. I thought that was best.
He spoke quietly and carefully, balancing on the words, but suggesting he was in danger at any moment of falling off into the crater of feeling beneath.
I should never have done it. I should have sent a letter. A letter would have been enough. If I had simply stuck with the letter, I could have...
She waited, but he stared out at the horizon. He seemed to have forgotten that he was talking. "Still," she said, "I'm surprised, after everything you did, that Queenie said nothing."
At last he turned and met her eye. His face, like his voice, was drained of life. "She can't. She has no tongue."
"I beg your pardon?"
Maureen's gasp walloped the air. "I believe they've cut it out. Along with half her throat and some of her spine. It was a last-ditch attempt to save her, but it hasn't worked. The cancer's inoperable because there are no operable bits of her left. Now she has a tumour growing out of her face." He looked away, back towards the sky, with his eyes half closed, as if he was blocking out the external world in order to see more clearly the truth that was taking shape inside his head.
"That's why she could never talk to me on the telephone. She can't speak."
Maureen turned once more to the sea, trying to understand. Far out, the waves were flat and metal-coloured. She wondered if they knew the end of their journey lay ahead. Harold's voice came again.
"I didn't stop because there were no words for me to say. There weren't when I first read her letter. Maureen, I'm the kind of man who thanks the talking clock. What difference was I ever going to make? How did I ever think I could stop a woman from dying?"
A violent surge of grief seemed to force its way through him. His eyes crumpled shut, and his mouth opened, and he sat tall as his mouth emitted a series of soundless sobs.
"She was such a good woman. She wanted to help. Every time I drove her, she brought something nice for the journey home. She asked about David and Cambridge."
He couldn't finish. His body was shaking with it, his face twisted as fierce tears screwed up his eyes and his cheeks.
"You should see. You should see her more. It's not fair."
"I know." She reached her left hand around Harold's and held it tight. She looked at the darkness of his fingers on his lap, the blue ridges of his veins. Despite the strangeness of the last weeks, she knew this hand so well. Even without looking, she knew it. She kept hold as he wept. He grew calmer, a quiet flow of tears. He said,
"As I walked, I have been remembering so much. Things I didn't know I'd forgotten. Things about David and you and me. I've even remembered my mother. Some of the memories have been hard. But most of them have been beautiful. And I'm frightened. I'm frightened that one day, maybe soon, I will lose them again. And this time it will be forever. His voice wavered. Taking a new, brave breath, he began to tell her all he had remembered. The moments from David's life that had opened up for him like the most precious scrapbook. I don't want to forget his head when he was a baby. Or the way he slept when you sang. I want to keep all those things. Of course you will, she said. She tried to laugh, not wanting to continue with this conversation. Although she could tell from the way he kept on looking at her that he wanted more. I couldn't remember David's name. How could I have forgotten that? I can't bear the thought that I might look at your face one day and not even know you. She felt pain pricking at her eyelids and shook her head. You're not losing your memory, Harold. You're just very, very tired. When she met his gaze, it was naked. He held her eye and she held his, and the years fell away. Maureen saw again the wild young man who had danced like a demon all those years ago, and filled every vein of her with the chaos of love. She blinked hard and wiped her eyes. The waves kept throwing themselves further and further up the shoreline. All that energy, all that power, crossing oceans, carrying ships and liners, and ending just a short distance from her feet in a last flume of spray. She considered all the things that must happen from here. There would be regular visits to the GP, there might be colds that turned to pneumonia, there would be blood tests, hearing tests, eye tests. Maybe, God help them, there would be operations and periods of convalescence. And then, of course, there must also follow a day when one of them was alone for good. She shivered. Harold was right. It was too much to bear. To have come all this way and discovered what it was you wanted, only to know that you must lose it again. She wondered if they should drive home via the Cotswolds and stop a few days, or maybe take a detour and go to Norfolk. She'd love to return to Holt. But maybe they wouldn't. It was all too big to contemplate, and she didn't know. The waves fell over and over and over. One day at a time, she murmured. She moved close to Harold and lifted her arms. Oh, Moore, he cried quietly. Maureen held him tight until the grief passed. He was tall and stiff. And her own. You dear man. She groped for his face with her mouth and kissed his salty wet cheeks. You got up and you did something. And if trying to find a way when you don't even know you can get there isn't a small miracle, then I don't know what is. Her mouth trembled. She cupped his face in her palms. They were so close now that his features lost distinction, and all she could see was the feeling she had for him. I love you, Harold Fry, she whispered. That is what you did.
Chapter 31 Queenie and the Present. Queenie stared at the blurred world, and found something she had not seen before. She narrowed her eye, willing it into focus. A pink, shining light that somehow hung in the air, twisting, and every now and then sent a myriad of colour across the wall. It was beautiful for a while, and then to keep hunting for it was too tiring, and she let it go. She was almost nothing. Blink a moment, and she'd be gone. Someone had come. And now they had gone. Someone she liked. It wasn't the nuns, although they were all kind. It wasn't her father, but it was another good man. He had said something about walking, and that was right, she remembered, he had walked. But she couldn't remember how far he had come. Maybe it was from the car park. She had a pain in her head, and she wanted to call for water, and she would do that in a moment. But just for now, she would stay here, lying very still and easy at last. She would sleep. Harold Fry. She remembered now. He had come to say goodbye. Once she had been a woman called Queenie Hennessy. She did sums, and wrote with an impeccable hand. She had loved a few times, and she had lost. And that was all as it should be. She had touched life, played with it a little, but it is a slippery bugger, and finally we must close the door and leave it behind. A frightening thought for all these years. But now, not frightening. Not anything. She was so tired. She dropped her face against her pillow and felt something opening like a flower in her head as it grew heavy. There came a memory long forgotten. It was so close, Queenie could almost taste it. She was running down the stairs of her childhood home in her red leather shoes, and her father was calling her. Or was it the good man, Harold Fry? She was rushing and laughing because it was so funny. "Queenie!" he was calling. "Are you there?" She could see the shape of him, tall against the light. But he kept calling her and casting his eyes everywhere except where she stood. The breath caught with a knot in her chest. "Queenie!" She longed for him to find her at last. "Where are you? Where is that girl? Are you ready?" "Yes," she said. The light was very bright. Even behind her eyelids, it was silvery. "Yes," she called, a little louder so that he would hear. "Here I am." Something twisted at the window and showered the room with stars. Queenie parted her lips, hunting for the next intake of air. And when it didn't come, but something else did, it was as easy as breathing. Chapter 32. Harold and Maureen and Queenie. Maureen took the news quietly. She had booked a double room close to the seafront. They had eaten a light meal, and afterwards she had run Harold a bath and washed his hair. She had shaved his chin carefully and moisturized the skin. As she trimmed his nails and rubbed his feet, she told him all the things she had done in the past which she so regretted. He said it was the same for him. He seemed to be coming down with a cold. After she had taken the call from the hospice, she reached for Harold's hand. She told him exactly what Sister Philomena had said. The Queenie looked peaceful at the end, almost childlike. One of the younger nuns believed she had heard Queenie call something just before she died, as if she were reaching for a person she knew. "But Sister Lucy is young," said Sister Philomena. Maureen asked Harold if he would like to be alone, but he shook his head. "We'll do this together," she said. Already the body had been moved to a room beside the chapel. They walked behind the young nun without speaking, because words at that moment felt too hard and too brittle. Maureen could hear the sounds of the hospice, the hushed voices, a brief peal of laughter, the slushing of water in pipes. From outside she briefly caught birdsong. Or was it singing? She felt she had been swallowed by an inside world. At a closed door, They stopped, and again Maureen asked Harold if he would like to be alone. Again he shook his head.
"I'm frightened," he said, his blue eyes searching hers. She saw the panic in them, the anguish and the reluctance. And then it dawned on her, very suddenly. The only dead body he had ever seen was David's, in the shed.
"I know. But it's all right.
I'm here too.
It'll be all right this time, Harold."
"It was a gentle end," the sister said. She was a plump girl with a rosy bloom to her cheeks. Maureen was comforted that such a young, vibrant woman could care for the dying, and remain so full of life herself.
"Just before she went, she gave a smile, as if she had found something."
Maureen glanced at Harold, and his face was so white, he looked bled.
"I'm glad," she said. "We're glad it was peaceful."
The nun stepped away and then turned back, as if she had remembered more.
"Sister Philomena asked if you would like to join us for evening prayer."
Maureen gave a polite smile. It was too late to become believers now.
"Thank you. But Harold is very tired. I think what he needs most is rest."
Unperturbed, the young woman nodded.
"Of course. We only wanted you to know that you are welcome."
She reached for the handle and opened the door. Maureen recognized the smell of the air as soon as she stepped inside. It held an iced over stillness, imbued with incense. Beneath a small wooden cross, the body that had once been Queenie Hennessy lay with her white hair brushed over the pillow. Her arms were stretched over the sheet alongside her body, and her hands were open, palms uplifted, as if she had willingly let something go. Her face had been tilted discreetly towards the pillow, so that the tumour was mostly hidden. Maureen and Harold stood beside her in silence, coming to terms once more with how utterly the life vanishes. She thought of David in his coffin all those years ago, and how she had lifted his vacant head and kissed him over and over, not believing that her wanting him alive wasn't enough to bring him back. Harold stood beside her, with his fists clenched into balls.
"She was a good woman," said Maureen at last. "She was a true friend."
She felt something warm against the tip of her fingers. And then she felt the pressure of his hand gripping her own.
"There was nothing more you could have done," she said.
And she was thinking now, not only of Queenie, but David too. Though it had cleft them apart and plunged them into separate darkness, their son had, after all, done what he wanted.
"I was wrong. I was very wrong to blame you."
Her fingers squeezed on his. She grew aware of light, spilling under and above the door, and the sounds of the hospice filling the emptiness like water. The room in which they stood had grown so dark that the details lost definition. Even the shape of Queenie was dimming. She thought of those waves again, and how a life was not complete without meeting its closure. She would stand at Harold's side as long as he wanted. When he moved, she followed. Mass was already underway as they closed the door on Queenie. They paused, uncertain whether to give their thanks or slip away. It was Harold who asked to stop a moment. The nuns' voices rose, woven in song, and for one splendid, fleeting moment, the beauty of it crammed her with something that felt like joy.
"If we can't be open," Maureen thought, "if we can't accept what we don't know, there really is no hope."
"I'm ready to go now," said Harold.
They walked along the seafront in the dark. The families had packed up their picnics and their chairs. Only a few dog walkers were left, and some joggers in fluorescent jackets. They talked about small things. The last of the peonies. The day David started school. The weather forecast. Small things. The moon shone high, and cast a trembling copy of itself over the deep water. Far out, a ship travelled the horizon, its lights twinkling. And yet so slow its passage was not visible. It was full of life and activity that was nothing to do with Harold and Maureen.
So many stories.
So many people we don't know, she said. Harold watched too, but his mind was full of other things. He couldn't say how he knew it, or whether the knowledge made him happy or sad, but he was sure that Queenie would remain with him, and David too. There would be Napier and Joan, and Harold's father with those aunts, but there would be no more fighting them, and no more anguish for the past. They were part of the air he walked through, just as all the travellers he had met were part of it. He saw that people would make the decisions they wished to make, and some of them would hurt both themselves and those who loved them. And some would pass unnoticed, while others would bring joy. He did not know what would follow from Berwick-upon-Tweed, and he was ready for that. A memory came of the night all those years ago, when Harold had danced and spotted Maureen watching him across the crowd. He remembered how it felt to fling his arms and legs, as if shaking off all that had come before, while witnessed by such a beautiful young woman. Emboldened, he had danced more, even more crazily, feet kicking the air, hands like slippery eels. He had stopped and checked again. She was still watching. This time she had caught his eye and laughed. She was so full of it, her shoulders shaking, her hair slipping over her face, that for the first occasion in his life, he had not been able to resist the temptation to stride through a crowd and touch a stranger. Beneath her velvet hair, the cushion of skin was pale and soft. She had not flinched. "Hello, you," he had said. His childhood was shorn away, and there was nothing but himself and her. He knew that whatever happened next, their paths were linked. He would do anything for her. Remembering, Harold was filled with lightness, as if he were warm again, somewhere deep inside. Maureen pulled her collar up to her ears against the night. The town light shone in the background.
"Shall we turn back?" she said. "Are you ready?"
In answer, Harold sneezed. She turned, wanting to offer a handkerchief, but was met with a short gasp that was almost without sound. He smacked his hand to his face. The noise came again. It wasn't a sneeze or a gasp. It was a snort, a snicker.
"Are you all right?" said Maureen.
He seemed to be trying very hard to hold something inside his mouth. She tugged at his sleeve. "Harold?" He shook his head. The hand was still plastered against his mouth. Out shot another snort.
"Harold?"
she said again. He held his hands either side of his mouth, as if attempting to straighten it. He said, "I shouldn't be laughing. I don't want to. It's just..." He let out a full-blown guffaw. She didn't understand. But a smile was tugging on the corners of her mouth, too. "Maybe we need to laugh," she said. "What is it that's funny?" Harold took a deep breath to steady himself. He turned to her with those beautiful eyes of his, and they seemed to shine through the dark. "I've no idea why I'm remembering this. But that night at the dance, when we first met," her smile was beginning to make a noise, "and we laughed like kids,
Oh, what was it you said, Harold?
A roar of laughter bowled out of him with such force he had to grip his stomach. She watched, her smile all bubbly now, ready to erupt, so nearly with him, but not quite there yet. He had to bend over with it. He actually looked in pain. In between splutters, he said, "It wasn't me. It wasn't what I said. It was you."
"Me?"
"Yes. I said hello, and then you looked up at me, and you said..." She got it. She remembered. The laughter kicked up from her stomach and filled her like helium. She slapped her hand to her mouth.
"Of course."
"You said..."
"That's right."
They couldn't say it. They couldn't get it out. They tried. But each time they opened their mouths, it was so hilarious they were hit by a fresh wave of helpless laughter. They had to grip hands to steady themselves.
"Oh, God," she spluttered. "Oh, God." It wasn't even very witty.
She was laughing and trying not to, so that it came in sobs and squeals. Then another laugh whooshed up behind her like a huge wave, catching her unawares and erupting into a violent hiccup. That made it even worse. They hung on to one another's arms and bent over, shaking with how funny it was. Their eyes were streaming. Their faces ached.
"People will think we're having a joint heart attack," she roared.
"You're right." "It wasn't even funny," said Harold, wiping his eyes with his handkerchief. For a moment, he looked sensible again.
"That was the thing, love. It was ordinary. It must have been funny because we were happy."
They caught hands again and walked towards the water's edge. Two small figures against the black waves. Only halfway there, one of them must have remembered again, and it passed like a fresh current of joy between them. They stood at the water's edge, not letting go, and rocked with laughter.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. This program was directed and produced by Nicholas Jones Strathmore Publishing. Executive producer, Julie Wilson. Text copyright 2012 by Rachel Joyce. Production copyright 2012, Random House UK, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.